It's Tuesday, January 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the United States and South Korea consider further moves against North Korea following Pyongyang's recent bomb test.
But I think it's a normal reaction in cases like that to increase your alert.
Chinese stocks stabilize, and fans on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean continue to mourn the passing of the late rock legend David Bowie. It's all ahead. On Monday, South Korea and the United States discussed other U.S. strategic assets that could be deployed on the Korean Peninsula. The discussions occurred a day after the U.S. flew a long-range B-52 bomber over South Korea in response to North Korea's latest nuclear weapons test. Sunday's flight followed North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's defense of last week's test of an alleged hydrogen bomb as the legitimate right of a sovereign state and a fair action that nobody can criticize. South Korea has urged the international community to impose harsh sanctions against the North for the nuclear test, its fourth since 2006. White House spokesman Josh Earnest said Monday the U.S. is closely consulting with its allies and is committed to preserving the international unanimity of opinion when it comes to confronting North Korea.
So we are committed to preserving the international unanimity of opinion when it comes to confronting North Korea, and that will only strengthen our hand in this effort. That said, we have indicated that there are a variety of appropriate responses, and we're going to continue the work to develop those responses.
Curtis Scaparotti, commander of U.S. forces and the U.N. command in South Korea, put U.S. forces on their highest level of alert Monday in case of any provocation from North Korea. The South has limited access of South Koreans to a joint industrial complex with the North in Kaesong and resumed cross-border propaganda broadcasts. Pacific Forum security analyst Ralph Kossa tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, aside from joint maneuvers with South Korea, there are other strategic assets the U.S. might deploy.
I would expect that one of the things they'll discuss is the THAAD, the high-altitude air defense system that's been rumored to be going to Korea for a year now, and which everyone has been excited about. So this would certainly be a way both to send a message to the North Koreans and also to put more pressure on the Chinese, who are not big THAAD fans, to continue to pressure Pyongyang. Beyond that, I would very much doubt that they would actually deploy B-52s or B-2s or any of those type of weapon systems to Korea. They may, come in on a temporary deployment or a visit or a flyover like the B-52 did the other day. But it would be very doubtful that they would actually try to base them there.
And why would that be?
It's a major undertaking to base a new weapon system in Korea. It means bringing in an awful lot of logistics support. You don't base a plane somewhere without having the ability to repair it and keep it running and the crews and the support equipment and et cetera, et cetera. So it's not just a matter of flying in a couple of planes and having them sit there. There's a lot of people that have to come along with it if you're going to keep it there for more than a few days.
We understand that the U.S. presence in Korea, some 28,500 troops, were placed on a high state of alert in the wake of what has transpired. Is that a sign of how serious the U.S. is taking this?
Well, yeah. I mean, if I was in charge, I probably wouldn't put them on alert. I'd tell them to take a vacation for a week or so, since the North Koreans are certainly not going to do anything right now except hunker down and wait to see how everyone responds to what they've done. But I think it's a normal reaction in cases like that to increase your alert, even though I think the odds of something happening that would require military forces to be on alert is probably lower now than it would otherwise be.
Does all of this activity change North Korean behavior in your view?
No. Sending the B-52s to overfly Korea certainly gets them upset and gets them agitated, but it's not going to either make them not have more tests or have more tests. They're following their own timelines as to what they're doing and why they're doing it. It certainly sends a signal that we're serious, and that's a useful signal to send, but it only has an impact on the margins.
Another analyst, Bruce Bennett of the RAND Corporation, says what could get North Korea's attention would be if China, its chief ally, cut oil, food, or medical supplies for a time. He describes Beijing as pretty upset over Wednesday's fourth nuclear test. Well, for a reaction on social media, I'm joined by International Edition's Olin Akisholu.
Hi, Sarah. Well, when news spread last week about North Korea's supposed hydrogen bomb test, a lot of people on social media had their doubts. And one researcher tweeted out some evidence that could support those doubts. Melissa Manum, a senior research associate at James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies, she tweeted photos of her team analyzing submarine-launched ballistic missile footage. It's a different launch, released from North Korea. Her organization is saying it's proved North Korea doctored this footage that was released from a December launch, and they wanted to make it look like the missile didn't actually fail. She also tweeted that a video of the testing will be uploaded to the website armscontrolwonk.com sometime today. And that video should be pretty interesting to check out.
Certainly will be. Well, what else is trending?
Worldwide, hashtag Istanbul and hashtag Sultan Ahmet are trending after news that an explosion in Istanbul's Sultan Ahmet Square. The most common response from people on social media is disbelief, and many people are tweeting messages saying their hearts and prayers are with the victims. That's mostly how the hashtags are being used. However, some people have also started speculating that ISIS is connected in some way with the attack, even though we don't yet know who's responsible. CNN Turk journalist Erdem Aydın tweeted, "There is confirmation, but I think the target, method, and recent history point at ISIS cell behind the Sultan Ahmet blast." Recently, other journalists have started tweeting that senior Turkish security officials are saying ISIS is likely responsible for the attack. But people also don't seem as surprised as you might expect from this latest explosion. Ayla Albayrak is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal in Turkey, and she tweeted some photos of the area around the blast that show a lot of people walking around. And the message, quite busy around Sultan Ahmet after 2 hours after the blast. Many tourists around, terrorism becoming commonplace.
All right, that's Olin Akisholu. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
NASA is taking the potential threat posed by near-Earth objects, such as asteroids and comets, more seriously than ever, and has established the new Planetary Defense Coordination Office. The space agency says the new office will oversee all of its efforts in finding and characterizing all celestial objects that travel close to Earth as they orbit the sun. It will also coordinate any actions within and outside of NASA that may be needed to respond to such potential threats. Near-Earth objects are found by astronomers who use a worldwide network of ground-based telescopes as well as NASA's space-based NEOWISE infrared telescope. So far, astronomers have discovered more than 13,500 near-Earth objects, which vary in size from small boulders to those that are hundreds of kilometers in diameter. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we talk with one of the editors of a book about the late rock singer David Bowie. Chinese stock markets stabilized Tuesday, with key indices in Shanghai and Shenzhen posting modest gains after losing 10% last week and 5% on Monday. But Asian markets remain near four-year lows, with investors concerned over the state of China's economy, including the depreciating currency, the yuan, and plunging oil prices, now at a 12-year low. Scott Kennedy of the Washington-based Centers for Strategic and International Studies tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, global concerns don't reflect reality in China, the world's second-largest economy.
They think they're in control, and they have a strong idea of what they're doing. It just doesn't happen to be what markets think they're doing. But I don't think that things are out of control. China's view is that they are implementing a wide series of reforms that are complicated and it'll take several years to implement, but they know the direction that they're going in. And in the meantime, they need to ensure economic stability along the way. which everybody should understand, in which if things went south with the exchange rate and stock market too much, people would panic. So they're trying to avoid that. At the same time, the view from outside is that the government is overly intervening in the economy, in the stock market, in the exchange rate, and that's causing a loss of confidence. And so the Chinese government and markets are speaking past each other, and that's getting worse every day.
Are the fundamentals, in your view, still strong in China?
I think long term, yes. China's got good reasons why it should be able to grow at a relatively rapid rate over the next decade or more. But it does have a significant debt burden, and its demographics are shifting toward a population that's going to have more retirees than working people, which will slow growth for sure. Population growth overall is slowing. But there's good reasons if they implemented the right types of economic policies, they'd grow well. They're just not doing that right now. They're making a series of mistakes, and that's what markets are concerned about.
What are those mistakes?
They've mismanaged the handling of the stock market, both driving it up last year and then intervening overly and in a ham-fisted way to stop the slide. The way they've handled the adjustment of the renminbi's exchange rate, the reforms that they announced for state-owned enterprises, which really weren't much of any serious reforms as far as we can tell. All of that add up to a sense that Beijing has lost its way and isn't committed to economic reforms the way previous leaders were. And that doubt is what is leading people to be worried. It's what's leading money to look to get out of China and why the stock market's down.
Scott Kennedy of CSIS says China is not inevitably headed toward a crash or financial crisis, but he urges Chinese leaders to get serious about clarifying what their policy goals are and the tools they intend to use to reach those goals. Investor faith in the Chinese economy will continue to deteriorate. He says the record shows that in the past 35 years, Chinese leaders have shown the ability to learn from their mistakes and make necessary adjustments. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
My name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. Fans of British rock music legend David Bowie are still coming to terms with his death. The singer died of cancer Sunday at the age of 69. In New York, where Bowie lived along with his wife, the model Iman, fans left flowers, candles, and photos outside his building. Across the Atlantic in London, admirers there held a sing-along in Brixton, the section of the British capital where the singer was born in 1947. The crowd sang selections from Space Oddity, Rebel Rebel, Rock and Roll Suicide, and Starman. Owen Devereaux is a professor at Limerick University in Ireland. He's one of three editors who put together the book David Bowie, Critical Perspectives. He spoke with International Edition's Francis Alonso.
The amount of influences that Bowie drew upon. I mean, we were really struck when we were doing the book about the array of influences on Bowie, how well read he was, his interest in cinema, in mime, in acting, in reading, you know, so many influences, poetry, different musical movements and so on. And his ability then to bring those together and draw upon them almost like a magpie in a nice way and use them in his art, in his music. I think what's also striking was obviously his ability to reinvent himself and to, I suppose, to the end, to be true to his art and not to worry too much about commercial success, even though that was important, but he was always experimenting, always willing to change.
He just released a new album. What can you tell me about that?
The album was released on his 69th birthday. The album is called Black Star. And even over the weekend, I was looking closely at the lyrics and indeed the video content associated with the album. And it's a very interesting record in the sense that it fuses lots of jazz and electronica and hip-hop. But what's striking, really, really striking about the record is the songs are largely about a man who is coming to terms with his own mortality, particularly the song Lazarus. The video for that is very complicated, very complex, but it's very, very telling. Here is a man, you know, thinking about what's going to happen when he dies, looking back on his life and so on. And indeed, that connects with the album that he released on his birthday in 2013. And again, he was reflecting on his previous work as an artist and coming to terms with growing old and the prospect of dying.
Speaking of dying, his death just caught the whole world by surprise from cancer. Is that typical of him to be private, even though he was a very public person?
Well, he's a very public person, but remember, David Bowie, as we understand David Bowie, is a construct. David Jones, the person, is very, very, very different. And I think it's quite striking in an age of social media, of Twitter, of Facebook, and so on, when he was re-emerging in 2013, he was recording an album for 2 years in New York City, and nobody knew about that. There were no leaks, there were no rumors, nobody knew anything about it. And just on his birthday, he announced, "Today I'm releasing some new music." So he was very much in control of what he was doing, and I suppose essentially, from what I understand, essentially a private person.
Now, where do you think his influence will be felt most?
I think it will be in combination, to be quite honest. I mean, he's obviously influential in terms of bands and in terms of how even how images are constructed around bands and people reinventing themselves, like Lady Gaga and others. People are reinventing their image. From the vantage point of 2016 and, you know, given, you know, changes in values and so on, I think sometimes it's interesting that we tend to forget how shocking he was in the early 70s. I mean, he really challenged assumptions that we might have about gender, about sexuality, and so on. So I think that's, again, you know, something very, very strong in the art he created. He was a truly wonderful performer, and I'm glad as a human being to have experienced his music over the years. And, you know, I'm very sad about his passing, but his contribution has just been so immense.
And we'll close today's show with one of Bowie's biggest hits, Rebel Rebel, from 1974. That's our show. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The end of the year 2015 brought with it encouraging news. For over 42 consecutive days, no new cases of the Ebola virus disease were reported in Guinea. This development marks the end of the original chain of transmission in the West African Ebola outbreak. Ebola is a viral hemorrhagic fever with average mortality rates ranging from 25% to 90%, depending on the specific strain. According to the World Health Organization, by the end of December 2015, this most recent outbreak resulted in 28,638 cases of the disease and 11,315 deaths across 10 countries, including the three hardest hit, Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. The epidemic began in Guinea in December 2013 and soon spread, at first undetected, through Guinea and into neighboring Liberia and Sierra Leone. The World Health Organization's announcement of no new cases means that the three countries have successfully broken this deadly chain of transmission and are now recovering from the disease. This represents a significant milestone for Guinea, West Africa, and the international community, wrote Deputy Assistant to the U.S. President for Homeland Security, Amy Pope, in a recent blog post. Nonetheless, she wrote, West Africa is still at risk of reemergence of Ebola and other infectious disease threats. Reintroduction of the disease from survivors or animal sources is still possible, and amidst the chaos of the epidemic, other diseases, such as malaria, have continued to flourish. The fragile health systems in the affected countries were overwhelmed and need time and investment to recover. That is why the United States, along with other countries that aided the West African communities hardest hit by the epidemic, continue to work with Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia to develop long-term capacity to prevent, detect, and respond to infectious disease outbreaks. And since the economies of all three countries were hammered by the epidemic, we are helping them restore basic health services and assisting economic recovery. Addressing the unique needs of the most vulnerable members of society is also critical to restoring a positive development trajectory to the region. The U.S. government stands ready to help respond to any new cases of Ebola and continues to work with the governments of the affected countries and partners to sustain the gains made by building local capacity, wrote Ms. Pope. The United States is committed to standing with Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone now and into the future.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.